when we when we first come to practice, and for a long time, of course, there's a lot of mental involvement of understanding something of Buddhism, something of practice, and we have a lot of sifting and a lot of things that we have to settle in order so that we can become focused and committed to what we're doing. And it is largely, almost exclusively, a mental process, of course. What else can it be? And then we, so that we can orientate ourselves and make sure that we're doing the thing that we really want to do. And then we take on a meditation practice that, again, for the most part, has a great deal to do with the mind, thinking, the logic even, and learning how to put these particular practices into effect. So much of our experience up to this point has been up here, up in the head, up in the nama, in the immaterial. And this is, as I say, is unavoidable. It's what we have to do. But I think for a lot of us, this then becomes our way of practice, our habit, the way that we pursue the Dharma, is that it has to be said, for a great number of people, become a mental process, become a something that to understand and to work out. If I can just understand that other little thing that I can't quite understand, if I can understand that, then I'll be becoming more wise. Things will change. I will start to become the thing that I want to become. I will become that step closer to being enlightened. And so we proceed primarily, start off as a mental exercise, if you like, a mental experience, and then continue to proceed in that same mode. And this, for a lot of us, I'm quite sure, is what we do. And we are very deeply conditioned beings, and everything in our life that we've done up to now has had a massive mental involvement. Most things we've pursued and accomplished mentally, to do with our intellect, our intelligence, our education. This has always been in the driving seat, and has always, usually, when we've achieved something, it's through that vehicle, through that means. And like I say, we bring that same mode of doing things to our Dharma practice and stay very much in that mode, which to me is like practicing from the neck up, primarily, and expecting that samsara is going to fall away one day, just as soon as I work it all out. And then wonder, after so many years of practice, that in fact it doesn't change, it doesn't fall off, and a lot of us, a lot of the time, still feel as trapped as we ever were in our own restricted way of living. And I would suggest the reason for that is that what we've done, we've come to Dharma because life is unsatisfactory, and the reason why life is unsatisfactory, for the most part, is that we actually only live a part of us. We only live a part of ourselves. We live in our heads, and that's our life. Our life is driven by our intellect and our understanding. And for the most part, remarkably, we ignore what is a far greater part of our makeup, which is our body. We seem to think of the body as just being this material thing, this thing made up of all sorts of funny things that actually, you know, is very convenient in many ways, but actually it's got nothing to do with the price of fish. And we think, well, what's the body got to do with the Dharma? And then just proceed to ignore it. I think this is just such... is such a massive mistake. And what this practice will do, this awareness practice, because it's not conceptual, because we're not developing something mentally, trying to understand something, trying to go somewhere, trying to create something, trying to achieve something, which is always a mental exercise. It's bereft of all of those features. Just about, not 100%, but just about bereft of all of those features. We're left rather sort of lost as well, you know, what. Okay, now I can't lose myself in all of this thinking and trying to work something out. What on earth is all this? Is what is it about? What's going on here? How do I practice? Well, we practice by turning into that which we've ignored, that which we thought was superfluous, irrelevant, in fact, probably an impediment, actually, in many ways, to the practice, to the development of understanding. And that's the rupa, the body, the form, that which is really what we are. Up until now, we've completely ignored it and wonder why we're still trapped in samsara. We've completely ignored what is the greater part of ourselves. And because we're not caught up in intellectual development, we have much more opportunity to learn to come into the body. And now this is something big. This is mega. This is revolutionary. To actually learn to turn the practice away from the head and bring it into the body, into the form. And what cultivating awareness will awaken us to, I hope, well, I'll cut a few corners for you and tell you this in case you haven't realised. You know, most of the stuff, me and mind, whatever it may be, we assume, we're certain, is like existing in the head. Our consciousness, our feelings, our sight, our sound, all of these things are all somehow tied up with the head, and the mental world that we create that becomes me and mine. And we also, as I think I touched on yesterday, that awareness too is a part of me and mine. And we assume that awareness, of course, is part of that family, and awareness, like everything else that belongs to me, is also a part of my mental makeup. It is somehow existing up here along with all the other stuff. So awareness is a part of the furniture that fills my head. Through learning to give our attention much more to awareness itself without getting lost in configurations and in formulas and things. Awareness, a part of the nature, if you like, the characteristic of awareness, the more that we abide with awareness, the more things start to become clear. I guess that's fairly obvious. And one of the, I think, quite startling revelations through learning to return to our awareness, not just in our sitting meditation, but throughout our day, is that we can make the startling discovery that actually awareness isn't in the head at all. And that's quite difficult to accept, certainly on an intellectual level. But the more that we can open to awareness, the more that we can become familiar with our awareness, the more we will see that actually isn't in the head at all. In fact, we discover that awareness is actually in the body. How mysterious. And that it's centered in the body. But even that's questionable. But provisionally, to help get us going, to help us make that leap, that we can say that awareness is actually centered in the body. But as I say, even that becomes questionable in time. But let's take that first step and say that awareness, quite mysteriously, is in the body. And in order to polish, to nurture that ability to stay with our awareness, we discover that, you know, this isn't something we can do mentally, because it just doesn't, it's not of that order at all. In order to polish awareness, we discover that we have to come to where it is, where it is actually emanating from, where it actually lives, and it's in the body. And we discovered that actually, if we're serious about this practice, that we have to learn to turn ourselves away from the head, be locked in the head and caught up with all of our views and opinions and that endless chattering that goes on, and actually learn to come into the body, and actually learn to come into the body, to be aware of the body, live in the body, and then live out of the body. So that soon, what was once a mental practice and a mental process actually transforms into a physical practice, into a physical transformation. That in order for this whole maturing process to take place, we have to learn to come into the body and learn to live out of the body as a physical experience. A physical experience is not a mental experience. The mental comes after the physical. First there is the physical experience, the direct impact of what is, what we are engaged with, what is in front of us. And this is where the heart, the very heart, the very centre, and the very transforming process of this type of practice is to be found. Once we begin to awaken to this, it totally transforms our whole engagement with the Dharma, I believe, our engagement with the Dharma, what it's about, how it works. It brings a completely different quality. We begin to realize that the truth, that the Dharma, the transformation process that we all want, is actually very present, actually in this moment. It is not a mental thing that we're creating, that we're trying to understand, but is actually learning to be with the experience that's in front of us as a concrete experience, as concrete, before thinking, before putting labels on whatever, saying good, bad, right, wrong, I like, I dislike, before we fall into that old trap of creating the dualistic world of opposites, of likes and dislikes, etc. We discover the practice is in that direct impact, which is in the here and now, which is physical, before all of that thinking. And by learning to see that this is where actually all practices ultimately will bring us back into that moment, and that moment is before thinking. All practices, if they're true and if they're cultivated correctly, will ultimately bring us back into the body and bring us back into the moment. When we're in the moment, we're in the body. And when we're in the body, we're in the moment. To discover that this then really is much more of a physical practice, to discover that awareness is in the body, that awareness, when awareness becomes more and more polished, we discover that this samsaric world, this dualistic world that we create, that we get so attached to, that we get so enslaved to, that we become such a victim of, that pulls us around, is not some mental thing that's whizzing around in our head at all. We actually discover that samsaric world also is in the body. Our whole understanding, because we've been so locked in our head, we seem to draw everything up. Everything is all up here. Whereas in fact, if we learn to embrace and open up to the whole of ourselves, all of that really does really become, comes into doubt, that in fact that samsaric world is actually not in the head at all, is in the body. And this is very much the path of understanding. This is the whole process of insight and of wisdom, to discover that awareness is in the body, that samsara is in the body. And as we all know, all of us good Buddhists know, that samsara and nirvana are not two. So even nirvana is not something that we imagine, something that we create, but actually is already with us. That release, nirvana, is actually already with us, and that too is in our body. So it's hardly surprising, actually, that we seem to spend so many years whizzing round, feeling we're not getting anywhere with this practice, and discover we're actually in the wrong place to start with. We've managed to lose ourselves, to get caught up in this dualistic mental configuration, that when we actually look at it with honesty, it's just hot air, isn't it? It's just like transparent. Is there anything there? Can you grab any of it? Is there anything substantial there at all? Well, the answer is there isn't anything substantial, and yet somehow we imagine that everything that's going on is all about something that's really quite firm and quite real up here. Learning to turn away from that, to come into the body, to discover this is where awareness is, this is where our true home is, where the whole world and its release takes place, is actually in the body, is actually the process of reintegrating. What we're doing is that we're pulling that mental thing that seems to have taken us over, that we are completely encircled by. By learning for the first time to come into the body, we're actually drawing back, we're drawing in that whole mental side of ourselves into the body, into the rupa. The nama is coming back into the rupa to reunite, to reintegrate, to become whole again, because that's the basis of why we are what we are, is because we are split, we are not integrated. We've become separated from ourselves, from the whole of ourselves. And this practice, the very heart of the practice, is about reintegrating mind and body, but rather doing it from the mental side and somehow trying to pull the body up into the mind. We're doing it the other way round. We're pulling the mind back down into the body and discovering as we go along that actually everything is in the body anyway. We're not creating anything, we're not transferring anything, we're actually discovering what is actually there. But how many of us actually live in the body, in our bodies? How many of us actually live in this mental world that we create? And I think if we're all honest about that, we would all put our hands up, because that's precisely what we do. And this practice will nurture that ability to turn away from that habit of learning to live in our heads and to try to work life out in our heads, and actually put in place the parts, the components that go to make us up, the important parts, the important components that go to make us up, where liberation is to be found, is actually in the body, and it's through awareness. And that is a massive shift. And to discover that not only do we discover awareness and discover that actually really we are awareness, that this is what we really are, this is where my life is really situated, where my life is really grounded, it is actually in that very awareness. To discover that grounding, that reality is actually in my body, and to discover that the world that I get caught up in, that pulls me around all over the place, actually also is in the body, and to see that release, the release from that world, that insight, that understanding, that wisdom is actually also in the body, that it's actually already there, that it isn't something that we create, and it isn't something that we discover in our heads, but we actually discover wisdom in our bodies. And I say it's a discovery. A discovery means that it's already there. It isn't created, it is discovered. To discover, to realise that the discovery of wisdom and release is also in the body. And also another component that is so vital, so crucial to the whole process of understanding, is to also see that our emotional base, the emotions that we live out of, the emotions are what we are. If we didn't have emotions, we wouldn't be alive. We are emotions. It's just that our emotions manifest in different levels of intensity. But this is at the very heart of life itself, is emotion. And those emotions are also in the body. So why do we spend the whole of our time up in our heads trying to work all this out? Why are we just looking in the wrong direction? to discover that emotion, on top of all of these other discoveries, that emotion is actually at the basis, that energy, that volition, that is life itself, is at the very basis and gives life to the samsaric world that we all get entrapped by. Because samsaric world is very much a mental configuration. The dualistic world is something that's created by our mental states. The subject and object, the me and the world out there that I have to protect myself from, is a mental creation. That's not physical, that's a mental creation. And then we get lost in that world and we try to possess it, manipulate it, control it, and do all the things that we do in order to protect ourselves, because now we are frightened, lonely little beings. We've managed to separate ourselves from the whole and create that loneliness and that sense of separation. All of this is mental. a mental construction, a mental invention. And underneath that is something that gives all of that volition, that brings that world into life, that makes that experience real for us. Not just a mental construction, but something that actually becomes real. And that which gives that mental construction life is our emotions. It's the emotions and the sense of self that grows out of, becomes a part of, and possesses those emotions. So those emotions then become me and mine, a part of me and mine. And it's the emotions that we learn, we begin to discover, is what gives the volition, the life, to that whole dualistic world that we create. And discover that actually, in the transforming process that we all like to be engaged with, so that things do go into change, so that things drop off and things that we're entrapped by fall away, and maybe more wholesome, more skillful things take their place. All of that has an engine room, has a thing that gives everything life and volition, and that's our emotions. And that's our emotions, again, are in the body. Everything is in the body. Nothing but hot air is in the head. It's all real. Everything that's truly real is actually in our form, in this thing that we've completely ignored, probably. Certainly in our dharmic life, we've just ignored this. Now suddenly it becomes the absolute focus of practice. And to see that reviewing, getting to know and reviewing the wholeness that's actually within our body, and to see that the thing where everything swings on, where everything twists, where the world arises, where that world where we get caught up in, that we then are so convinced that is real, we reinforce it over and over and over again with our engagements, with our experiences, so that we create karma, so that we create this wheel of becoming, this wheel that just turns and never stops. And we are forever feeding it, we are forever giving that wheel, the volition keeps spinning that wheel so that it has no end. To discover that all of that is actually made possible through our emotional, through emotional volition. And it's that that we need to focus on more than anything. Not so much the mental world that we create, that we're always trying to figure out, why am I like this, why am I like that, and then trying to unpick it, try to cut it up into bits, hang labels on. And Buddhists love to hang labels on mental experiences, and there's a whole raft of, you know, labels. There's a whole branch of Buddhism that does nothing else but create labels to hang on experiences. Again, just things that are created. To actually get to the heart of that experience is what we need to do in order for this transforming to be genuine and to be permanent and to last forever. And that truly can happen, is that we need to get into the engine room. So the engine room is no longer creating that volition, creating that heat, creating that world, then get lost in. Our attention, because we now come into our body, we now become awakened to the importance of the body and to see that how the whole thing is knitted together and how the whole process is put into motion and kept in motion is because of the emotional energy and volition that becomes a part of that, part of that creation. And to see that what we need to do, rather than concern ourselves with all the pictures and all the scenarios and all the bits and pieces that we want to work out. And as we all know, these things go on forever, don't they? As soon as we work one thing out, something else pops itself up. Or if we do work something out, suddenly it grows another arm or another leg and off we go again. And on it goes. And even if you do work something out, so what? There's always something else to take its place. In Zen Buddhism, they call this the 10,000 things. I mean, that's a slight understatement. 10 million might be a bit closer to the mark. Where these mental things just keep being created one after the other. That seduces us, that draws us in, that carries us away, and we're always trying to work out, oh, I'll work this one out, and then I'll go and work this one out. And when I've worked them all out, everything will all be, I will become enlightened. And get stuck into all these different pictures, all these different thoughts, all these different scenarios, forever trying to work them out, and knowing in fact all they do is just roll on to the next one. When we come into the body and we realise the importance of the emotional volition, the emotion that those things get their life from our emotions, we can forget about the 10,000 things. We don't have to bother about trying to work everything out. What we can now do is to actually turn our attention to that volition, that fire, that energy that brings the world into life, and actually learn to enter skillfully how we can enter into learning to let those fires burn out without the creating the worlds that we then get lost into. Again, in the body, again, it's awareness. But now we're not being sucked up here, being drawn up here into the 10,000 things, but we're actually getting right down to the heart of the matter, that which gives all of this world of ours life. And learn to turn our attention to our emotional involvement, our emotional enslavement, when circumstances come up, the way our emotions just fuel and just help to bring all of these things to life. So our aversions, the way that we react when something comes along that we don't like, or the way that we react when there is something that we desire. That emotional grasping, attachment, I want, or I don't want. All of this comes, we got the picture, we got the scenario, but that is what it is. It's the life force that comes up, that makes that real, that creates the volition of grasping, of attachment, of our desires, our aversions. And maybe the worst of those experiences is the one of fear. Fear that can have pictures, but fear can also just be that naked experience of fear, of loneliness and separation, which is fear. All of that is mixed up and a part of our emotional experience. Now, if we can work on the emotion, if we forget the 10,000 things, but focus on the emotion, so that that emotional energy that builds up, that helps to create these worlds, if we can somehow allow that emotion to transform before it gets caught up into the world, what happens to the world? The world becomes disempowered. It becomes weak. It becomes transparent. It fades away. And the things that we've been caught up in before, our desires and our aversions and our fears, go into change. And this change takes place by learning to focus on the emotion rather than on the 10,000 things. That, I think, is quite a radical shift. In fact, it most definitely is a radical shift. And it's very much at the heart of this type of practice, because we're not in the mental game with pure awareness. We're not in that game. We're not trying to work it out. We're not trying to decipher the 10,000 things and trying to work out why I'm like this and why do these things happen. We're leaving those things alone, and we're looking at that which gives the whole, all of those things, life. And without that life force feeding that dualistic world that we create, it will fade. That wheel, that turning, that volition that is possible through the energy becomes less and less, and that wheel gets slower and slower and more transparent, until ultimately it will stop. And it only needs to stop for a few moments, and in that stopping, this is when awakening takes place. And this is where ultimately, this is where we will all eventually find ourselves, if we can enter the transforming process that are the emotions. So then the question is, how do we do this? Well, you know, we're creatures of habits. We like to blame our karma. We're creatures of habits, we're conditioned. And when something comes into our experience, if we're familiar with whatever that experience may be, we have a reaction. Maybe we run towards it, maybe we run away from it, whatever it may be. We're all different in that regard, and yet we're all the same. But we have different pictures and different scenarios. But there is always there's always a volition there that makes us react to that experience. And this is what we call attachment, is that we react and we want to possess in some way whatever it is in front of us. Is that through awareness, the jewel in the crown, the jewel that is the gateway to liberation, which is awareness. When we come to a situation, a familiar situation, where we've reacted in a particular way, we've done it all our life, we may know it, but we just fall down that same old familiar pattern of reactivity. Awareness gives us a little gap, a few moments, because we have awareness, where we as human beings, unlike the animal world, we can say, no, I'm not going to do it. Animals follow their instincts. When the mouse runs across the floor, the cat will jump or will chase the mouse. The cat doesn't stop there and scratch his head and think, well, shall I chase this mouse? Shall I kill this mouse? Is it a black mouse? Is it a white? It could be quite nice, but I'm not sure. I've just had my breakfast. I don't really feel like it today. You know, generally speaking, a cat, like all animals, when it's confronted with a situation, will just instinctively, it doesn't have that self-awareness where it can reflect, where it can make a decision, change its decision. That's what we have, and it's that precious self-awareness is where the liberation from samsara comes. And it's in that split second, because we're alive with our awareness, rather than be dragged into our old habits, we say no, and we restrain ourselves. But what will happen then, because that emotion, because it has not been allowed to expend itself by going down whatever avenue that it's been used to going down, by saying no, we are in effect, we're learning to contain that energy. We're learning to contain that emotion. And that emotion is born in the lower part of the body, below the navel, as we know. This is our seat of our emotions. This is where the energy gathers to create our emotion. We learn to keep it there. And we learn to try and function and carry on and live our life in a normal and as a human way as possible, not to become some sort of a zombie where we just freeze, but actually learn to deal with the situation, learn to live life, but do it in a contained way, learn to restrain from falling down our old habits of aversion and desire, mainly. Learn to restrain and to stay with that emotional experience. Again, it's in the body. Again, it's before thinking. It's absolutely concrete. It's actually very much now. Again, the main characteristic of this type of practice is that it is very much in the moment. It is very much a direct experience. It is not a mental configuration, a mental process, but a direct physical experience. And to learn to contain that energy. Now, that, it depends on the situation. It may get bigger and stronger, depends what your attachment may be. Or it may be something maybe not quite so important to you. But nevertheless, it can have its impact, and we can feel that energy building up. Learn to carry that. Learn to open up. Learn to open up to whatever it is that's... whatever the experience is, learn to open up and say yes to it, and not... but and see that this is not a process of suppressing, but a one of containing. And that containing means that you give it space, that you allow it to, as it were, to play itself out in front of you without you being sucked into it and being carried away by it, being blinded by it. And that's where awareness is so crucial. If we can retain our awareness, then this then becomes possible, where we can reflect, we can see, we can know, whatever it is, whatever that thing is that's always just completely possessed me in the past, now I'm beginning to be able to just give it that space, allow it to play itself out, and then that whole process of insight, of understanding what's going on, can then begin to come into being. And at the same time that we're doing that, this all becomes possible because we're learning to restrain and learning to contain that volition that wants to, like a volcano, a fire, as several branches of Buddhism likes to call it, the three fires of greed, hatred and delusion. That's what it is, a fire, it's an emotional fire. It's hot, it's powerful, it burns, it's alive, it is you. It isn't something that's come to get you. It is you. But what's happened is it's beginning to transform into that pollution of attachment, into the world that you've created. It becomes polluted. But by learning to contain it, we can begin to reflect upon that particular experience that we've had, begin to understand it, as helping us to understand and helping us to let go. But crucially, underneath that fire that's given the whole thing life begins to burn itself out, because it can't go down the path that it's always been used to going down, to expend itself, to express itself, because we've learned to contain it. It will, if we can retain that containment and learn to stay with it. And this is only possible again with awareness. Through awareness we can retain, because it's energy. Energy has to do something. Energy has to go somewhere. It can't be passive forever. And if we can learn to contain so that it doesn't go down its familiar channels of expressing itself, it will return to its original nature. It will return to its Buddha nature, its true nature, before it got caught up with you and your world. This is the transforming process. This is Buddha nature that's got polluted, that's got distorted. So when you see something as being unwholesome, as being destructive, as being something that you would just rather not have in your life, that really impinges and has such an effect on your ability to practice, and is something that you don't want, and is something that's in the way, that you may even call a hindrance, you may have all sorts of names for it. That is the Buddha. And because it's the Buddha, we need to learn to develop a positive relationship, to learn to make friends with something that we can see as, you know, something that's we don't want in our lives, something that possesses us or makes us into something that we don't like, rather than see that as an enemy, as something that we want out the way because it's interfering with practice, because it's not what I want to be. We have to learn to open up to that and say yes, rather than create a conflict, rather than create a space and a negative relationship. We have to learn to open up and say yes, this is me, this is what I am, this is how I am, and learn to open up. And the more you can open up and accept, like the mirror that doesn't have opinions, that doesn't want to put everything in boxes, but learn to accept, not be carried away, not to fall down, go down the old familiar road, the trap of that reactivity, but learn to open up and say yes, this is a part of me, is the beginning of the process of making friends with yourself. It is the beginning of the healing process, of which Dharma is what Dharma is about. Our healing process, that the dualistic relationship that we have with ourselves, that so often is negative, that so often so much of what we see and what we are we don't want, and we try to turn our backs on, we try to push out the way because we don't want the dark, we want the light. We just want the light, we're going to push the dark out the way. When we do that, we cut ourselves in half. And if we're going to cut ourselves in half, awakening is impossible. It's not going to happen. It cannot happen. It's when we learn to open up and embrace the whole of ourselves, the dark as well as the light, that the healing process can begin to take place, so the dark and the light can come back into one. So to be whole and to be reintegrated. All of this becomes possible through awareness and through learning to contain the world that we create through habit, and through that fiery the fiery volition that gives life to that world, learning to open and to contain, and to see in time that through that process of learning to develop a positive relationship with ourselves, to learning to like ourselves, to learning to open and accept ourselves, which that is only possible by opening and accepting ourselves. This is where the whole process of change takes place. And that energy that once fired that dualistic world will actually begin to turn over and go back to where it once was, where it first came into being, which is back into its true nature, which is Buddha nature. And to see that so much understanding comes out of this, because we're in the body, we're in awareness, and awareness knows when we give it space, when we give it that, allow that clarity to come, when we learn to blow the clouds away from the sun, that awareness which has complete wisdom within it, begins to rise up, begins to shine, and when that rises up and begins to shine, all of that ignorance begins to go into change and begins to go back into its true nature, which is actually back into awareness itself. And to see that this whole process, however we want to dress it up, and Buddhists love to dress it up, people like to write books, there are all sorts of ways of dissecting and describing what we're doing, so much so we can spend a whole life studying Buddhism. It's a fantastic subject, and the whole process of insight and everything that's all tacked on around it is the most wonderful thing. But at the end of the day, what we do, what we're achieving, if you like, or what we are, or what is beginning to come out of our commitment to practice, is something incredibly simple. All we're doing, really, at the end of the day, when we read all the books, and good luck to you all if that's what you want to do, when we read all the books, all we're doing is making friends with ourselves. That's all it is. We're making friends with ourselves. We're learning to like ourselves. We're learning to accept ourselves. We're learning to allow that conflict, that dualistic world conflict that we create, that then we buy into. We learn to let that go. We learn to allow that to go into change. And in that going into change, we become whole again. We reintegrate all the fragments that we start off with, all come back into the whole, all come back into the warmth of the human heart. Nothing more than a process of learning to like ourselves. And from that like, we learn to love ourselves, not the narcissistic love, because that fellow who wants to love has gone. But we awaken to our natural state, and our natural state is one of love. Love for ourselves and one of love for all of life. And this is the ultimate fruit. It is one of love. And that love is only possible when we learn to make friends with ourselves. And all Dharma is about learning to make friends with ourselves. And if you want to make it more complicated than that, then you go ahead and do so. But to me, it's so incredibly simple. Does anybody have a question on this at all?
Could you expand a bit further on the idea of the samsaric world emanating from your body? I always had a sense that it was a mental picture, and it was my mental and could you say conditioned reaction to the moment to moment responses that creates my samsaric world. Mm. Now, but you're saying it emanates from the world.
Well, there comes a time when you do really begin to doubt this dualistic thing of something up there and something down here. That the mind, the whole mental thing is created and is up here. Once you develop not even this practice, that, you know, samadhi, strong concentration, where the dualistic world becomes highly questionable. In fact, it really dissolves. I mean, that's a definition of samadhi, is that you no longer experience, even if it's for a few moments, the duality of self and other, of me here and the world out there. You'll see, in fact, everything is one. You'll see that your mind and body aren't separate at all. That somehow we create this, somehow there is this space, but you know, this is all one. But we develop this idea that somehow that there's a separation that takes place, and it's in that separation, this is where we get lost. But it's only a mental creation. It is not you know, a physical reality, if you like, that actually, when you look at it and you begin to understand it, you'll see that actually it isn't something that's split in two, and you get to the stage where, okay, you know, you're quite happy to accept that your mind is like immaterial, but there comes a point where you even begin to doubt that your physical body is actually physical. Is that not too a mental configuration? You know, I mean, that's quite a leap, isn't it? We can accept the immaterial as being immaterial, but problem with the material being immature, do we not just create our own body as well with thoughts? The whole thing, everything within you becomes very questionable, and it is so wonderful, actually. It is so inconceivable, and it would be, we could say that it's really wonderful, but for the fact that it actually creates suffering. But actually the whole delusion that we create is just, you can't imagine it, how incredible that it is. And we all buy into it. Even the most intelligent and most brilliant people on the planet. I was thinking about when these things became clear, thinking about somebody like Einstein is like the symbol of, you know, intelligence and wisdom and worldly, you know, he's got it all sussed. Even he was deceived by it. Even he never cracked that one. That's how ingrained it is. That's how real it is. But we can unpick it. We can begin to unpick that, because it's because we bought into that. We bought into that duality. And this is a part of the duality you're talking about there. Because we bought into it, and because it's not real, then it's never going to work. It's never going to be satisfactory. It's only when we get back to the real is everything going to be settled and perfect, if you like, if you want to use that word. That it just becomes such an incredible concoction of delusion. But it's so amazing how it works. It's fantastic. I mean, only the Buddha could do it. Call it God if you like. I don't mind. Say God created it if you like. I'd say it's the Buddha, because I'm a Buddhist. But there's something so inconceivable that, like I say, we all buy into it. It's got nothing to do with intelligence. Nothing. In fact, the more intelligent you are, the likelihood the farther away from it you are. The reality and the way that, and the path back into the truth, the path into unpicking all of that, has got nothing to do with your intellect. Nothing. You must bring it into your body, beyond your conditioning, beyond your upbringing, and come back into that side of us that we've all got, and learn to nurture it. And this is the spiritual side, if you like, the spiritual path that is not exclusive from the intellectual side, but that side which does have a part to play, because we're humans, we need to sift things, we need some sense of things from time to time, is only a fraction of the whole picture. But we're so deceived by this thing up here that we invest even our whole spiritual quest into that intellectual side. This is what we do. It is so convincing that this is the way out of what we're stuck in, that we actually invest in the very thing that's actually creating it in the first place. And we need to learn to grow into that part of us that, you know, we've hardly had contact with, certainly not given it any great sort of importance. But in fact, it's that side that we need to learn to nurture and allow to open, because that's the gateway. That's the gateway to liberation, the freedom, the gateway to wisdom. Wisdom is here, not here. And learning to come into the body is the beginning, is the learning to go home, to be at home, to learn to abide at home, to live life from home, to stay at home. And when we're at home, we can begin to awaken to what's around us. This is the great, you know, it's the great delusion. It's fantastic, because I don't care who you are, what your background is, everybody has bought into it. But only a few have got out and learn to trust those that have seen, and learn to follow them with trust, because that's all you've got, faith and trust. You've got very little intellectual stuff to actually convince you, or that will help you to a great deal. Learn to trust that. Put faith into trust those that have actually walked away, and then it becomes possible for you, and then there's a real possibility for you. But it's not, faith and trust is not here. It's here, in the body again. It's here, in the body. Learn to bring that into your life. Learn to nourish it, and it will take you along the path.
Is this why in the Zen tradition so much emphasis is placed on bringing the intellect to an impasse, to a point where it can't reason and logic anymore?
So you give it up? Yeah, well, that's the koan practice in Zen. I mean, that was a skillful device invented by Rinzai, wasn't it? I mean, that was his particular, he developed a method, but that's it. Because we do get trapped by the mind, the thought, you know, our intellect, and we want to work. We can't do anything else. We're so conditioned that we do everything via our intellect. That's the way we are. We're completely and utterly sold into it. Completely. And so what he says, well, okay then, I'll accept that. You're going to get in your mind, right? So he gives you the question, which is, if you like, has a spiritual basis to it. It's not, you know, it's not trying to work out some mathematical formula. That, okay, smarty, here you are, work this one out with your head. And that's what you do, and then you take it and you take it into your intellect, and after a while you give it up because it's just gobbledygook. In much the same way as the Bodhisattva vows that we chant. Intellectually, it's nonsense. But you have to try and work it out. Say, well, can't do it. This is silly. Then it helps you to let that intellectual side go, and then you can go beyond the intellect, which means actually you're coming into your body, and then you will actually find the answer in your body, but it won't be a logical one. And that's the way he used to break, if you like. He used to break the attachment, the enslavement to the mental process. It also gave some life and vigor to the monks, to the practitioners, and with a whole series of barriers that people had to come up against and break through. But that breakthrough was never intellectual. That's the way he dealt with them. When all he's doing with those koans is bringing it into the body. The body is where wisdom is. Every question you've ever thought of, that you've ever wanted to ask about the path, wisdom, reality, truth, everything, I guarantee you, every one of those answers you'll find here. Every single one of them. I guarantee it. If you know how to come and to be and to nurture, every answer will. Because total wisdom is here. Why are we living up here? Just hot air. It's nothing. Isn't it? It's gabble, 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 gabble. And then when you're lying on your deathbed, I've got 10 seconds. I just got one more thing to work out before I die. Just please, 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 I just want to work this last thing out. We can't, we're just so... We're just so bought into it, haven't we? We can't let it go. This is what we're up against. Bring it into your body. That's how you let go. That's how it works. But you've got to train yourself to do that. Because everything inside of you says, no. Up here. And trust that it works.
Is this what we would call intuitive rather than logical.
It's intuitive. I always feel slightly uneasy about that word because it's very often abused, isn't it? You know, with people being intuitive intuitiveness can very often get caught up with your desires and wishes, and you can twist it and say, well, that's not me that wants that, it's my intuition is telling me. That self-interest actually possesses that intuitive side, so you have to be very, very careful. But when it's untouched by the self, then it will be pure. And it's got its feet in wisdom, it's got its feet in reality. But the danger is that, you know, that self can come and take it, and then we can think things are being intuitive, but it's only the self getting its own way.
I was just wondering if I could just add a few words, which was about different languages of the mind and the body, because I just found it helpful to think about myself in that, in a way, the mind has got a very loud voice, you know, because it's conceptual. It's got a very loud voice, and I quite like to think of the body as having a very quiet
that's,
voice.
That's exactly right.
One that you sort of have to learn how to listen to, because it hasn't got any words to it. So it's a bit like feeling your way. Okay, what language does it have? How can I actually hear the body? And when you start listening to the body, it automatically takes you away from the mind, and then you stop hearing those loud voices quite so much. Obviously, they're still there, but it is almost like learning another language.
Perfect way to finish. Thank you.